In 1958, WYSO went on the air.
Good evening. At this time, Antioch College begins its first official transmission on FM. This is station WYSO.
Those very first announcers, those were students.
With studios and transmitter on the campus of Antioch College, operating on a frequency of 91.5 megacycles by authority of the Federal Communications Commission.
All the programs were made by students. They recorded concerts and lectures. They did interviews.
Good evening. Welcome to Visit with a Senior Citizen.
WYSO has always been a place where people learned the art and craft of radio. And that tradition continues today. Welcome to a special hour of stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley. I'm Sarah Buckingham, the Community Voices Coordinator at WYSO. There are a few different projects that fall under Community Voices, but they all have a common goal: get more local voices on the air. Our biggest project is the Community Voices Training Program. 10 local people from a variety of backgrounds converged at WYSO this year to tell true stories with sound. They spent 5 months learning to record, interview, edit, and write for radio. This hour, WYSO is proud to present radio stories produced by our first group of Community Voices trainees. We started our training with some very basic recording and editing exercises. One of the early assignments was something called a sonic ID, a sound-rich version of the station identification that we're required to broadcast every hour. Here's Brooke Bryan's sonic ID from beside the Little Miami River in Glen Helen Nature Preserve.
It's just coming out.
It's purple crest. That's the first purple crest bloom we've seen.
Right, you're right.
So how do we identify it?
You turn the leaf over and it's very purple underneath.
It's almost shiny.
But they're actually pretty fuzzy.
The stems are fuzzy. It's lovely. You are listening to WYSO 91.3 from Antioch University, the only station bringing wildflowers to Dayton, Springfield, and Yellow Springs.
That was a sonic ID from Community Voices trainee Brooke Bryan. Let's hear another one of these short audio hors d'oeuvres. This one comes from Denny Eagleson.
Radical Roots is kind of fun because it's a bit of a pun. The fine hairs on the plant roots are called radicals, although it's spelled differently. The more common understanding of it would be radical as in not mainstream. What I'd like to do here is first have a place where I feel grounded and where other people can feel grounded, meaning that they feel comfortable and calm and centered and in touch with the place where they are. I think that we have to look at things radically different. There are a lot of things in society that need to change to address climate change and peak oil and why the pill Prozac exists. My overall intention is to change society so that everybody can have a good life and that we're treating the earth in a way that the earth also has a good life.
That was Amy Batchman of Radical Roots Farm. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, a broadcast service of Antioch University for Yellow Springs, Dayton, and Springfield.
That was Denny Eagleson's sonic ID, one of the very first exercises in WYSO's training program. Another early assignment was the Vox Pop, named after the Latin phrase Vox Populi, or voice of the people. In a Vox Pop, a producer hits the streets with a question and asks people for their opinion at random.
There are protests happening all over our country. The following is from the protests that happened in Columbus, Ohio, on Tuesday, February 22nd. This is what the people had to say about Senate Bill 5, a bill that would end collective bargaining rights for public employee unions in Ohio.
I'm an older teacher. I'm getting very close to retirement. The quality of education would be hurt if this bill passes.
If you look at the 5 states that do not have collective bargaining and look at their test scores for ACT, they are ranked among the lowest in the country. So it does affect the students in the long run. I think this issue is probably the most important one that's come up in my working career.
I don't know. My heart is, you know, a little heavy today. I'm from Central State, and I work there as a maintenance man. This will affect me and my family.
Yeah, I'm part of Union Local 606, Delaware City Firefighters. We're just hoping for the best, you know.
I have firefighters in the family. I have teachers in the family. like most other people from Ohio, I'm like two generations away from someone working in a coal mine. I mean, I come from labor.
I do think that Senate Bill number 5 will pass because the Republicans have the majority in the House and Senate. And I think that's very unfortunate for the people of Ohio. I think it's a very unfortunate trend for the whole country.
I'm Liz Cameron for WISO Community Voices. You heard from these Ohioans: Jan, Karen, Marvin, Matt, Michael, and Evan.
Sometimes Vox Pops tackle the latest hot button issue, as we just heard, and sometimes they're just for fun, like this one.
I think we better pinpoint your fears. If we can find out what you're afraid of, we can label it. Are you afraid of responsibility? If you are, then you have hypangeophobia.
I don't think that's quite it.
How about cats? If you're afraid of cats, you have aphasia.
Well, sort of, but I'm not sure.
Are you afraid of staircases? If you are, then you have climacophobia. Maybe you have thalassophobia. This is fear of the ocean. Or gerophobia, which is the fear of crossing bridges. Or maybe you have pantophobia. Do you think you have pantophobia?
What's pantophobia?
The fear of everything.
Ever have that Charlie Brown moment when it comes to the topic of fear? I'm Shelley Hulse, and today we find out how alike we really are as I ask the question, what is your biggest fear?
Seasons don't fear the reaper. Cockroaches. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm not afraid of zombies.
I'm very claustrophobic and being closed up in some place tight where I won't be able to get out. So my biggest fear is like dying and being in a coffin.
Right now, drowning is my thing.
The biggest fear since I was just a small child was the fear of being trapped in a fire and unable to get out.
I'm not scared of death myself, but others around me is what scares me.
My biggest fear is being on a two-lane road, being with a friend who's driving, and they decide to pass on a hill, because you never know what's going to come over the top of that hill. It's always been my biggest fear since I was, I don't know how old.
Railroad tracks or crossing railroad tracks and trains at night.
More recently, in my old age, I think I'm probably more fearful that I will die and that my family will not be able to survive from a financial standpoint.
My only fear, actually, is that my children would die before me. That's the only thing I fear.
My biggest fear is losing my children, something bad happening to my kids.
Now that I have children, I have a different kind of fear that I had before. I had, like, now it's about them. Like, I'm not really afraid of anything, but if something happens to them, it's totally different. It's like having your heart on the outside of your body.
My biggest fear is to be alone without people, because I'm a very social person.
My biggest fear is losing my job.
Becoming quadriplegic is my biggest fear.
My biggest fear is Alzheimer's.
My biggest fear is something pretty mundane and probably universal to everyone. It'd be like losing my hands or my eyes.
My biggest fear is that the human population will not achieve the highest level of spiritual consciousness that they actually can achieve.
The world is just kind of a crazy place right now.
As I heard my racing heartbeat in the headphones, stepping out to do my first piece, I realized I was conquering some of my own fears, getting out of my comfort zone, and asking others to share their thoughts about fear. These interviews were conducted at a zombie art show at Forefront Studios, downtown Dayton, and a local hospital. Whether you're a nurse or a mom or an artist, we all share fear. If Lucy were here today, she would probably tell us, stop worrying.
I'm Shelley Halls. Thank you for listening.
With new interviewing, recording, and editing skills, we set our trainees loose on the Miami Valley to produce short audio documentaries. In this first piece, Community Voices trainee Nick Long talks with executive chef Brian Rainey and sous chef Isaac Delamater of the Sunrise Cafe in Yellow Springs about what it means and what it takes to be local in a small community.
Standing with my back against a freezer in the glorified hallway that is the Sunrise Cafe's kitchen, I listen to Isaac explain what it means to be local.
Local to me is within like 150 miles of here. Most of our summer produce comes within like 5 miles of here. Local really means being able to reasonably ride a bike or drive to where this stuff is coming from. The essence of it is being able to speak to who you're doing business with.
As they knead out the next day's rolls from their fresh-made dough, I asked Brian and Isaac how being local changed their business.
Yeah, it's almost stupid to run a business like that. I mean, you spend all winter paying prices for produce from California, and then the local organic stuff comes around, you're paying 20, 25, 30% more. I don't know. I'm willing to compromise the cost no matter what. I mean, it's just... I mean, you have to buy local. It's what's supposed to be done. It's what used to be done, you know. And I guess it's also what sets us apart from the rest of them, or most of them anyway. There's still plenty of places that buy local in the summer.
Listening to Brian, it was clear he stood by his principles. I wondered if that was why Isaac chose to work for him.
He puts his beliefs at the forefront of most decisions, you know, and like, most people put the bottom line in front of their decision-making process, and we don't do that. And that counts for a lot more than it's worth in money, you know? At the end of the day, ethically, we've made the right decisions. And that sits a lot better with me and with Brian and with all of our employees than,
I'm sure, you know, customers too.
And with our customers. Yeah, I mean, that's number one, too. We put them first.
Now I was lost. How could the Sunrise claim to be locally supplied when it's impossible to grow food in Ohio winters?
You know, usually the local produce will hold out until December or January, like potatoes, apples, lettuce, yeah, all that stuff people can store. The one Patchwork Gardens was bringing us tomatoes, I think almost into January, simply because he picked lots of green ones at the end of harvest and letting them sit in his barn, and they ripened up. Nah, I think it was just until December we got those. Yeah. Really, though, in retrospect, it's like we're just taking steps. Every year we've been doing a little bit more, pickling a little bit more, saving a little bit more. And, you know, we have all these ideas for this year, too. And, you know, hopefully at some point it'll just all be. I mean, just as long as we adjust our menu and put enough back, then we could almost do it year-round on running off completely local food.
Almost, but not yet. The Sunrise has to purchase and ship certain items from non-local places during the winter, but not as many as you'd think.
Like, a big part of this process of preparing for becoming more local and more sustainable is being willing to take the step to just like not use things that aren't locally produced or aren't, you know, sustainably grown. We stopped buying tomatoes, you know, the quality of the product you receive in the winter is in no way comparable to what we can produce here locally in the summer, and we're not willing to compromise on that quality. It was an easy decision. Our customers supported us. They were willing to make the same choice.
I learned being local isn't just about buying and selling with people in your area. It's also about compromising with those people on what you can and can't live without. For WYSO, this has been Nick Long, Executive Chef Brian Rainey, and Sous Chef Isaac Delamater of the Sunrise Cafe in Yellow Springs.
The Yellow Springs Chamber of Commerce has developed a brand for Yellow Springs, particularly the downtown, in a bid to attract more tourism. But does the Chamber's concept speak for everyone? Community Voices producer Sevilla Mann wanted to find out.
The locally owned grocery store, Tom's Market, is at the heart of downtown Yellow Springs. People familiar with the town know that the space out front is an informal gathering spot. On a warm spring Sunday, you can almost count on some sort of musical performance there. The benches out front of Tom's are full. Bobby Turner has come up from Xenia.
I just like Yellow Springs. You know, I just come here just to sit, watch, you know what I'm saying, people stride through. I like the food here. And people here are, you know, set with their own ways, you know. And this is a real nice town to come visit, you know.
There are benches all throughout downtown Yellow Springs. Down the street from Tom's, there's one that's ceramic with an elaborate nature theme. It's occupied by three visitors from Centerville, including Mary Ritzert.
It just feels very peaceful to me. I like that. I mean, especially on Sundays, you go back to work Monday, come and, you know, just kind of have fun. And I like all the arts, the art community here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And of course, the natural surroundings with Glenn Helen and John Bryan.
Just across the street, two sisters, Jory and Maddie, were walking their dog on the bike path.
I like it because it's small.
What do you like about it being small?
That you can just walk there and there isn't exactly, you know, the whole rush of things, so you don't necessarily need to worry about cars. I also like that it's small, but it has a pretty wide variety of shops, too.
I first came to Yellow Springs as a visitor, and then I moved here and got a job downtown. That's when I discovered that those few blocks seem carefree, but economic reality there is tough. Businesses count on tourists. It hurts when bad weather or expensive gas keeps them away. And if it's hard for the business owners, it's really tough for employees. Like retail jobs everywhere, the ones downtown tend to be part-time with low pay and no benefits. I started to think that downtown couldn't do much to lift up young people like me who need work that supports them. But I decided to consult Karen Wintrow. She's the executive director of the Yellow Springs Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, you're right. I think that it's not going to be a huge source of upward mobility for our young people or for anybody working there. I think that it really is the professional jobs and, you know, maybe high-tech jobs and professional jobs that we really need to bolster the economy. The retail economy is a little bit more for the personal business owners and just for the ambiance and just the what Yellow Springs is. It's such an underpinning of what Yellow Springs is that's really the greatest strength and not specifically as an economic strength.
Downtown does hold a special place in the hearts of the people who live here. It's hard to pin down exactly why. Kate Hutnall works downtown just like I do, and she told me what she values about the downtown.
It's just important, you know, as a local, when you walk downtown, you stop and have quality conversations, people will say hi, people don't judge you if you're weird. Those are the things I appreciate, you know, that's more about the spirit of the town rather than the physical part of the town.
Whatever it is that makes Yellow Springs special, the Chamber of Commerce wants to draw upon it as it seeks to increase local tourism. The last few years, they've led a multimedia campaign known as Destination Yellow Springs. Its tagline is Find Yourself Here. Karen says it's helped bring more visitors to town. But what happens when you try to brand the qualities that make Yellow Springs what it is? Can you sell the specialness of your town without losing what made it special in the first place? These questions seem to be on other villagers' minds as well. Robert Paschel is a poet who also sells t-shirts downtown. He designs and screens them himself.
Like one of the ones that I really like that I sell is three Buddhist monk types chanting Om, and the caption is Om Land Security.
Robert has lived in town for 45 years. He said the growth of tourism is the biggest change he's observed.
Part of my come and go dubious yes and no about Yellow Springs is, you know, whether the image is, you know, taking the place of the substance. So that's the kind of gut churner for me.
A few months ago, I was on my way to the post office with an armful of packages from work. It had been a stressful day, and I was not feeling the charm of downtown. A sticker caught my eye while I waited for a traffic light. it had the colorful streetscape of the Destination Yellow Springs campaign. Usually there's a word above the image, such as shop or explore, and then the tagline below, find yourself here. But this sticker was different, and it made me laugh out loud. The word above the streetscape was consume.
And then below that is the phrase, fool yourself here.
That's a local artist known as Johnny No. He received the nickname while studying at Antioch College. The sticker I'd seen was his creation.
So this series of work, this is one of, you know, four pieces that all use different sort of permutations of that find yourself here to, you know, make statements about how I don't understand what that means to find myself here.
Johnny says his goal is to respectfully question what he sees as commercial values dominating the conversation about Yellow Springs' future.
One of the sort of catch-22s about this whole thing, that sort of the irony of it, is that much of the reason that many tourists come here is because of the cultural legacy and the richness of the culture and the diversity. And that's precisely what gets crowded out, or what, in my mind, that's what you run the risk of actually pushing that to the margins, and not feeding the growth of those things, and making your central focus one that's, you know, just really solidly sort of clustered around this idea of growth and progress and development.
And Johnny got a lot of positive feedback for his stickers. He put them out there at a time when Yellow Springs is in flux. It's lost three major employers in the last 10 years, and it's becoming older, more affluent, and less diverse. But Antioch College is bucking the trend with its plan to reopen this fall. We are all waiting to see if the college can make it. As for downtown, I think about the hurdles it faces every day when I'm at work. It seems like others here are watching and wondering, too. For WISO Community Voices, this is Sevilla Mann.
You're listening to WYSO's Community Voices Special, radio stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley. I'm Sarah Buckingham. In most parts of Dayton, and definitely in Oakwood, Charlie Campbell and accordion are synonymous. Community Voices trainee Luke Dennis first interviewed Charlie Campbell to learn about the formation of the Oakwood Accordion Band. He thought the interview would become part of a larger piece about community music making, but it became immediately apparent to Luke that his story should be about Charlie.
Charlie Campbell has an irrepressible enthusiasm for just about everything.
I'm thrilled to be here, Luke. This is such a blast.
Meet Charlie Campbell.
Roll out the barrel, we'll have a barrel of fun. Roll out the barrel, we've got the blues on.
Charlie Campbell has lived in Dayton for nearly 40 years. Most of those years were spent as the president of Miami Jacobs Career College. It was a stressful, high-stakes job that took up every minute of his time. On a whim, while waiting in the Hauer Music Store, Charlie took an interest in an accordion that was for sale.
So I buy the accordion, and I said to Jerry Hauer, hey, are there any teachers here? And he said, Charlie, they're all dead, but I'll try to find one for you.
Meet Charlie's wife, Molly.
How do you feel about having accordion music in the house?
I don't love it.
In surveys, the accordion tends to occupy one of the top spots on a list of the world's most annoying instruments, alongside the bagpipes and the kazoo. But Charlie loves it.
How would you describe the sound of the accordion?
Okay, it is unbelievable. The tones are staggering in all this stuff. And I've got to put in the other reason that I love the accordion is it's a people instrument. And it, you know, it never made it with the hoity-poity people.
Charlie casually took accordion lessons in the late 90s, but his position at Miami Jacobs took up most of his attention. Then he had a stroke.
So then one day I was playing golf. I'm in a golf league. I passed out. I had had a major stroke. I couldn't talk. I couldn't communicate. I assumed I was talking just fine, but it was all blah, 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 blah. My wife took me to a speech therapist, and the speech therapist, I do remember this, said, okay, we got to test Charlie's communication. And she said, all right, Charlie. And in the room where we were, there was a window, and there was a sunny day. And she said, okay, Charlie, where's the sky? Point to the sky. My brain was saying, you know, that's a word, but what the heck is it? And so then I just pointed to the floor.
The stroke affected more than just Charlie, of course. Here's his wife, Molly.
I was the caregiver, and I was the full-time therapist, and we were assigned homework, and you know, he had to learn to speak again and read again and he couldn't understand what was being said to him, and so that was all a full-time job. Yes, it was a very dark, horrible time.
As Charlie recovered from the stroke and started to reassemble his life, he realized he didn't want to reassemble it exactly as it was before. In fact, the stroke prompted him to break completely with the past.
I consciously said, and I said to my wife, hey, I don't want to go back doing what I did, and I'm going to sell the business, and I have no idea how we'll be able to live, but I could care less. I just want to do something different, because I figured, Luke, wait a minute. I could have been dead with that stroke.
What Charlie wanted to do turned out to be, if one had to fit it all under one umbrella, was to spread good news and good cheer. One way to do this was to develop a weekly email broadcast that shares the good news about what's happening in Dayton.
The Dayton Daily News, the TV, the radio, they're limited on what they're going to bother spreading the word about.
Is it also intentionally positive news? Is it in response to?
Of course, because most of the stuff you read on the newspaper or on television is about crummy things. And I don't understand why anybody cares about car accidents or potholes or all this stuff. Let's get the good news out. I listen to everybody, but if someone is grumping about something, I'm not interested in sharing the grumpy things that person is saying.
If something is happening and Charlie thinks it's remotely interesting, he'll include it, along with a link to the event. Categories include things going on, things that will be happening sometime, things kinda interesting, things very interesting. One hopes to always have their events listed in that last category. Charlie's personality comes through in every broadcast. It often begins with a strange word etymology that struck Charlie's fancy, or perhaps a link to his wife's blog. He always signs off with a flair. Charlie, I have two snow shovels. Need one? Campbell. Charlie, who loves the boogie-woogie, Campbell. And my personal favorite, in honor of Cinco de Mayo, Carlo, dos cervezas, por favor, Campbell. Another way to spread good news and good cheer was by forming the Oakwood Accordion Band.
And I was at some kind of a party, and I said to a lady, oh my gosh, I've got an accordion, I'm taking lessons. And she said, oh my gosh, mine's in the attic. And she said, I haven't played the accordion for years. So she then got her accordion out and dragged me over to her house, and I was a real beginner, and so she was playing with her accordion, having a blast, and then she said, I think so-and-so is also an accordion.
Charlie added members to the Oakwood Accordion Band, one accordion at a time. The band continued adding members and eventually was playing out 3 to 4 times a month at nursing homes, in the lobby of a local performing arts center.
Charlie likes to have fun, and one of the performances at the Schuster Center, some of the band members tend to take it very seriously, and that he doesn't like it when they do. And so we were watching, and he didn't look like he was having fun, and Marion turned to me and said, "My God, he's phoning it in!" So anyway, he doesn't like to phone it in. Yeah.
Charlie's curiosity is pushing his accordion playing in new directions. He loves the boogie-woogie and travels to Cincinnati every week for a lesson with boogie-woogie piano legend Ricky Nye, who Charlie was delighted to learn also plays the accordion.
So it's so fascinating to me to hang around and to be with Ricky Nye. And I just keep learning stuff, and then I go down in the basement and practice, and my wife, she'll start pounding. Yeah, oh yeah, and she'll be upstairs, and then she'll say, "Really, I gotta go to the grocery store. I've heard this too much."
He's also starting a new group with two other accordionists he calls Two Good Guys and Me. Their mission? To play the dance music of the 50s and 60s and take it into retirement homes.
We're putting together a band on how to involve the senior citizens or the retirement communities, how to involve them picking out what they want to hear, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And then we'll be performing it with them and with some dance people who will drag them out there to get them dancing. And some of those people we know will be in a wheelchair. There's a whole way to be having that person dance on the wheelchair. Yeah. And so I just think it'll be a fun time. We're going to have lyrics for those who want to sing along.
That's the future.
Yeah, that's the future.
I love it.
Charlie Campbell thinks it's great in Dayton. Skeptical? Give him 10 minutes and he'll have you thinking the same thing.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much for talking with me.
I'm thrilled to be here, Luke. This is such a blast. So this is just, now Ricky said, yeah, this may not be a boogie-woogie, it's a blues, but I like the...
Now from music to poetry. Paul Laurence Dunbar rose to eminence during one of the darkest periods of American history, the age of Jim Crow. Born the son of slaves, Dunbar's name became mired in controversy, and his work was viewed as self-hating. Now, over 100 years after his death, two local spoken word artists, Purity Chitwood and Christopher Wiley, discuss why Dunbar and his work are still relevant today, and share how they hope to build on his legacy. Caressa Brown brings us the story.
Known to our audience as Miss Purity, she's hosted the Utterance Project, traveled with poetry slam teams, and has been a keynote speaker for several mentoring programs.
How does Dunbar's message still resonate with you?
Well, We Wear the Mask is my favorite Dunbar poem. And although the wording may be different in what we say, we still wear our mask as African Americans. And that's basically what he's saying is that, yes, they may have wore their mask in a different way because they were hiding behind oppression and slavery and all of those things, but we still wear our mask as African Americans. We don't let people in on what's really going on with us. We don't highlight what's really going on in our communities. So we're still wearing those masks and making everything appear as if it's okay when it's really not. It's very relevant to what we're going through today. And there's other poems too. They're just written in a different language, like Shakespeare. If you really dig into Shakespeare, you'll see that it still applies to what's going on with us today. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile. And mouthful of myriad subtleties. But why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, they only see us while we wear the mask.
Like Dunbar, Purity was encouraged at an early age by her mother to write and be confident in who she is as a person. She stands around 5'5" and prides herself on not being a size zero. But don't ever call her plus size. She prefers the term full of flavor. And was inspired by We Wear the Mask to write a modern spin entitled Makeup.
Some people say that by covering up humble hands that met curling irons at 13 or skin that became unruly, that I'm somehow, like, fooling myself, and I'm starting to believe that they're right. But I'm sad to say that my deceit, it doesn't stop there. Let's not talk about the heels, because no self-described diva would ever be caught dead without her heels so that her appearance appears bigger than what it really is, or the shapers worn just about every day to hide the effects of what having a plump man child has done to my body. And although I love him more, the life and the scars still appear. I'm standing here in this, my makeup. But if I'm being dishonest, aren't we all? Aren't we all these sad translucents of mediocrity and conformity, scared that if we stick our necks out just enough, then people might hear the scratchiness in our voice from nights on our knees praying out to God, why me? Scared that if we stick our necks out just enough to cross the finish line, then they might see the fingerprints on our skin from when we allow people to touch us in our private places, that if they get close enough for us to remove our sunglasses, then they'll see the hurt in our eyes from fathers that never came home and see the hurt in our faces from hearts that have been broken too many times, scared that if we speak up just enough, and they might see that we aren't really what our makeup appears to be. So here's my confession. I'm a liar. Book me, arrest me, but please just don't ever remove my makeup.
Recently, Purity has started teaching the art of poetry to at-risk youth at the Braunberger Center in downtown Dayton. Joined by fellow poet Christopher Wiley, Purity shares her vision on reaching out and mentoring youth to use new and creative ways of expressing themselves without resorting to violence.
And I think that's a lot of what's going on with these young brothers and why they're so evil and why they're so mean.
Hating they are.
They're hateful because their mama did something to them or their daddy did something to them or somebody did something to them. And that's why poetry is amazing, because we're giving them a place to vent
all that expression.
Anger. And I think if people had a place to vent all the anger that they felt, then maybe it wouldn't be so easy to take somebody's life.
Christopher Wiley is the host of Poetry in Motion, a monthly poetry show held at the Bainbridge Banquet Center in the Oregon District. With over 200 people in attendance each show, Chris has been able to attract spoken word artists from across the country to perform here in Dayton, including several nationally recognized poets who have appeared on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam. With Dunbar's legacy serving as their inspiration, and the emergence of poetry venues like the Utterance Project and Poetry in Motion, both Purity and Chris see a modern-day renaissance taking place in the city of Dayton. Like Purity, Chris understands and appreciates the challenges faced by Dunbar to gain national recognition.
I mean, you gotta understand, this man died at the age of 33. Right. And this man was able to read and write and articulate himself at the age of 6. Yep. The thing is, one thing that really spoke volumes to me is the fact that he was the only black person graduating in his class. So he struggled with adversity during the time in the late 1800s. You gotta understand, it's hard to do anything as a black at that time. I feel his writing, and I understand his writing, because I can say this about myself, and I can say this about Purity as well. We talked about real life issues. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. And he spoke about his life to the point he actually wrote a poem called Life. Mm-hmm. And in the poem, he says, "A crust of bread in the corner to sleep in, a minute to smile, an hour to weep in, a pint of joy to a peck of trouble, and never a laugh, but the moans come double." That
is like... Raised in a single-parent household, Chris is all too familiar with the hurt that comes along with growing up without a father. But instead of acting out in violence, he chose to release his anger with a pen and a pad.
I tell people that I'm not really a chip off the old block, because my dad never seen my house. Nor did he ever take me to the barbershop. But he looked just like me, except he was nappy-headed and unbathed, 5 p.m. unshaved, mother tired because she'd unslaved for the man that ain't her man. Two jobs, two kids, too busy to understand how a world could drain so much, refuse to supply but demand. She was supposed to be your queen, because I was your prince. 25 years have passed, and I ain't seen you ever since the day I was born. Gone before I knew what happened, so my love for you was torn. I try not to wince and cry, but it'd be impossible not to mourn. When my daily routine is to wake up without a hug, a kiss, or anything. No smiles, no cards, just a woman without a wedding ring. Just me, my mom, and my sister, and them family pics without a mister. On top of the fireplace, next to the first place you ever hugged and kissed her. A woman so deserving, it seems like you would have missed her. But your absence has taught me that every male is not a man. I repeat, every male is not a man, but every child needs a hand. For those of you who can't relate, let me break it down so you can better understand. You ain't never gave me nothing but my last name. So if calling me your son was your only claim to fame, I wouldn't even frown upon it, because my savior has taught me never to look down on a man in shame. Despite you were gone, I had more blessed days to be glad. My granny asked the Lord to take the hate out of my heart, because that's what really made her sad. But it took 1,200 Bible studies and 2 baptisms to say the 3 words, I forgive you, Dad. I know you and Moms were high school sweethearts. You cheated and things fell apart. I look at the pics and want to hit restart, but my mama said no. He hurt me entirely too bad. But truly, I have learned to forgive you, Dad. Possessed by that white rock on your block, 8 kids outside wedlock push you to steal and set up shop with those belts, pots, pans, and needles, because you need those to dodge this pain and affliction, which led to your addiction. But I forgive you. Don't worry, Mom's taught me how to read and write, but not how to stand and fight. Crying on the kitchen floor, I just hated to see the sight of a woman that gave her all to a man that wasn't man enough to stand behind and catch her fall. But I forgive you. December 27th marked the day of my mother's homegoing and the rebirth of your ongoing lies that you articulated to us for most of our lives. You didn't respect her enough to hug the family, say a word, and wave a couple goodbyes. Honestly, I don't know you and you don't know me. So all these years I've been scared and discouraged. I built my bravery and courage for the things I've learned to forget, forgive, and forbear much. I made it this far without you, and I doubt you really meant to neglect me. So much time had passed, you didn't think you still could protect me. So my only goal for you is to read this. With these last steps and these last breaths, from the bottom of my heart, as I shout to the top of my lungs, I want you to know that I forgive you for all the heartache and pain, and I love you.
For WYSO, I'm Caressa Brown.
As Dayton's poets work to break the cycle of violence with verse, a hidden horror goes on around the state, human trafficking. There are 2 types of human trafficking, forced labor and sex trafficking. Ohio has a problem with both. Until recently, Ohio was considered part of the Dirty Dozen, one of 12 states that pretty much ignored human trafficking altogether. As WYSO's Community Voices producer Liz Cambron reports, it's a myth that slavery ended 150 years ago.
We're in the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. The museum has a new wing dedicated solely to human trafficking. This is the only permanent exhibition in the world dedicated to modern-day slavery. Entering the space feels like entering a haunted house. You're greeted with low lighting and really eerie music, and you're surrounded by giant cargo boxes that are stacked to the ceiling. The boxes are labeled. One box says, 30-year-old bricklayer, male, submissive from Mexico. Another box says, 25-year-old female, slightly used, Ukrainian sex slave, HIV negative. You understand that this experience will not be pleasant. Soon after leaving the exhibit, I meet 2 girls from a diversity camp and ask them how they feel.
It was sad. Like, I didn't realize that this was still going on in the world. It just hurts, for real, to see that this is still happening.
What struck me the most about having a conversation with these girls was that even after touring the exhibit, they still had no idea that trafficking happens in Ohio. This is surprising to me, since the FBI has ranked Toledo 4 in the nation for human trafficking, and has ranked Toledo 1 for the most concentrated number of pimps, johns, and prostitutes in one area. It is estimated that 1,000 Ohio-born children are forced into the sex industry every year, and up to 60 children are trafficked every night in Columbus. What I realized is the museum does do a good job focusing on international trafficking, but it only has a small plaque dedicated to Ohio's victims. This information can be easily missed on a tour. A representative for the museum said that's because Ohio is actually doing well compared to other states and countries that don't have statistics at all. Tony Talbot thinks Ohio could be doing better. He's a political science professor at the University of Dayton.
Once you explain this to them, explain that slavery still exists, people will nod and say, of course, in third world countries, in the less developed world. Actually, as I said earlier, human trafficking is sort of an equal opportunity oppressor.
Tony is also one of the founders of Abolition Ohio, a nonprofit group that seeks to abolish modern-day slavery in Ohio. Tony and other professors at the University of Dayton helped write and pass a law last December that finally makes human trafficking a crime in Ohio.
Human trafficking is a standalone felony now. That's a good thing. We've criminalized human trafficking. We're going to go after traffickers. We need to increase services for victims. This is the hard part, because this is going to cost money. If you find three or four 13 or 14-year-old girls who've been forced to prostitute, what do you do with them when you found them? You can't put them in juvenile hall. That's not very good. You can't just release them back out onto the streets or put them back into the same potential environment where they became trafficked in the first place. There's something called re-trafficking that takes place. If someone's vulnerable, they're still vulnerable if you don't do anything to help them. So we need to help these people.
Tony and Abolition Ohio have also been working to open a shelter called Grace Haven House, which will be in Columbus. They hope it will open soon. We are at a fundraiser called Walk a Mile in Her Shoes for Grace Haven House. The premise is this: you pay $50 to walk a mile in stilettos. The message is primarily for men, and plenty are showing up to find hundreds of pairs of high-heeled shoes in their size.
So I am a 10 medium, I think, which is interesting. I practiced a little bit. I don't know how anybody ever walks on these things.
Sponsors line the hallways with tables. I meet a woman named Karen who is wearing a t-shirt that says she has a name.
We sell t-shirts, and our t-shirts will be coming. They're just not all here yet. We found out about human trafficking and what was going on and even downtown Columbus last fall. We learned that there was a story of John who was coming up to the pimp and asked the pimp what the girl's name was. And the pimp said to him, "She doesn't have a name. She's whoever you want her to be." So we just felt like, okay, she has a name. So that's where the "she has a name" came from.
Everyone here seems to be in good spirits. And they're having fun.
Have Band-Aids. And some blisters. Yes. And thirsty people. We have water.
But I'm reminded of why I'm here when I see a group of young Girl Scouts walking by with t-shirts that say, "It could have been me."
Grace Haven House, they'll provide around 10 beds. But that's 10 for the whole state. So a new law's got to provide more services and more funding for services for victims.
Abolition Ohio and other activist groups are working on what is called safe harbor legislation. For WISO, I'm Liz Cambron.
You're listening to Radio Stories produced for WISO's first Community Voices training program. We've traveled all over the Miami Valley this hour. Now, let's head out west. Tucumcari, New Mexico is located on a remote desert stretch of Interstate 40. Good for a tank of gas, a brief cruise along what remains of historic Route 66, and a close look at a giant wind turbine that serves as a beacon of the town's future. But to Dayton artist Susan Burns, this place is the site of an annual homecoming, the Mesa Lands Iron Pour.
What you're hearing is the sound of artists on vacation. We're using sledgehammers to break old iron bathtubs into about 2.5 tons worth of tiny shards. We've gathered in Tucumcari for the annual Mesa Lands Iron Pour, a workshop for making sculptures out of cast iron. It's held at the college's foundry, a part of the sculpture studio used for metal casting. I've just driven 1,200 miles to get here. A lot of people pass through Tucumcari on their way someplace else. It's a lonely pit stop halfway between Amarillo and Albuquerque, which are almost 300 miles apart. The town originated as a railroad camp called Six Shooter Siding because of its reputation for attracting itinerant outlaws, gamblers, and gunfighters. In the 50s, it was known for its wide neon-lit boulevard with 2,000 motel rooms built to accommodate Route 66 travelers. I first came through here in 1976 when my mother got a speeding ticket during a family trip driving across the country. Participating in the Iron Pour is a strangely seductive experience. It's attractive because it's kind of dangerous. And although creating a sculpture is important, many people who do this, including me, are even more drawn to the challenge of the process.
So what do you think about this Iron Pour?
Oh, you know, this is just playing with the gods of fire in a way that's pretty damn cool.
Over the course of a week, we'll work in a sprawling outdoor sculpture yard filled with heaping piles of scrap iron, forklifts, and the sound of powerful air blowers that feed oxygen into the foundry's furnace so that it can heat broken iron pieces into a molten state. On the actual iron pour day at the end of the week, we'll melt the iron and pour it into our molds to make sculptures.
And we're going to smoke the sage. And it's just breathe it in if you want to join us. You let it flow over you, kind of quiet your mind, and let you remember what's really important about today. Let's focus and be careful, all right? Come on, guys.
Today, it's finally iron pour day.
You don't get blisters, you lose meat.
That's DeGene Jawrunner, my friend of many years, and the professor who runs the foundry at the college.
Offer it in peace.
What have you got there, Pat?
I've got the sacrificial offerings to be offered to the gods of fire.
What are the sacrificial offerings?
DeGene won't let us use real chicken, so we use marshmallow peeps.
The day of the pour is full of rituals, like making sacrificial offerings of pink, yellow, and green marshmallow peeps, and breathing in the smoke of ceremonial sage, intended to secure our safety and good fortune. Early in the day, we feed iron shards into the furnace, which get melted down into a 3,000-degree liquid. Artists covered from head to toe in bulky silver fire protective suits wait close by for heavy loads of molten iron to be discharged. Teams of two carry the loads over to molds in a crucible, a special fireproof bucket that holds the red-hot liquid. This goes on throughout the long, hot afternoon. By evening, the filled molds smolder as they cool in the sculpture yard. Everyone is tired but excited because we've saved what's called a reaction mold for last. It's designed to produce spectacular pyrotechnic effects. Two tall, silver-clad men move carefully through the smoke. They carry between them a crucible full to the brim with radiant orange liquid. They begin to pour it into the mold. This mold is made of thick wood planks that ignite upon contact with the molten iron. Tall flames ripple into the night air. You can hear the sizzling. The iron is almost vaporizing the wood.
That was like Satan was breathing or something.
The morning after the iron pour, we chisel out our sculptures, pack up, and prepare to depart until next year.
That was Susan Burns on her annual trip to the Mesa Lands Iron Pour in Tucumcari, New Mexico. This has been an hour of radio stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley. I'm Sarah Buckingham. The work you heard this hour was produced in WYSO's first Community Voices training program. Our training project was made possible by the Yellow Springs Community Foundation and the DPNL Foundation. Special thanks to all our Community Voices producers, Caressa Brown, Brooke Bryan, Susan Burns, Liz Cambron, Luke Dennis, Denny Eagleson, Shelley Hulse, Nick Long, Savilla Mann, and Katie Tilly. The next training will happen this fall. To find out how you can be involved, send me an email, sbuckingham@wyso.org. And thanks for listening.
For everyone, please get back, give us room, please. Fresh cut flowers right here. You know, I think right now this might be one of the best deals in the world. Right now, right here, right now. God bless you, sir. God bless you all, like Tiny Tim. Two bunches for five or five for five? We have dropped the price. We are desperate, young folks. We are making deals. There's two dozen roses in this one, though. That's unbelievable.
$5, please.
This is the Flower Man at the, what is this, the PNC 2nd Street Public Market, and I love listening to WYSO. That sounds smooth, doesn't it? It's YSO. Yeah.